In El Salvador, women can go to jail for having a miscarriage or other medical complications in their pregnancies because of the country's strict laws banning abortion.
Anybody who arrives to the hospital under the suspicion of having had an abortion is denounced immediately to the police.
But one Salvadoran woman is free now after serving nearly 3 years in prison. I'm Marco Werman. Her story this hour, plus a U.S. Special Envoy for Ukraine, tells us that Russia is in denial and refusing to help end the conflict in eastern Ukraine.
Russia still denies its responsibilities for leading the occupying forces and for paying for them and for preventing a ceasefire.
And for Americans who live in Ghana, the history of slavery is even more complex. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Good to have you here. We begin today with the story of Evelyn Hernandez in El Salvador. 21 years old, she spent nearly the past 3 years in prison. This week, though, she was acquitted of the murder charges that landed her in jail. In 2016, as a teenager, she was raped and became pregnant. She delivered a stillborn child and ended up in the hospital. Hernandez was suspected of having had an abortion, then charged with murder and sentenced to 30 years. In El Salvador, abortion is banned in almost all cases, without exception. But yesterday, a reversal for Evelyn Hernandez. Her supporters there outside the courthouse, "Yes, we did," they were chanting. Paula Avila Guillen worked closely with Hernandez's defense team in San Salvador. Avila Guillen says Hernandez was in fact prosecuted for a medical emergency.
Unfortunately, she got raped and she kept bleeding during all her pregnancy, and to the point that she didn't even know that she was pregnant, and nobody in her family realized that she was pregnant because she didn't develop like traditional typical symptoms of pregnancy. And anybody who arrived to the hospital under the suspicion of having had an abortion is denounced immediately to the police. But the story of Evelyn is unfortunately no unique. It's very similar to the story of 15 other women who remain in prison in El Salvador, women who come from very poor backgrounds where the system has already failed them. They don't have the money to pay private attorneys when they are interrogated at hospital beds and who are sent from hospitals to prisons.
Right. So she stood trial, then appealed the guilty verdict. What did the prosecution argue?
They were trying to argue something that would be closer more to a negligence, a criminal negligence. However, they were still charging her under the homicide law, and they were asking up to 40 years in prison. However, because of the international attention and because of a strong legal team, we were able to present Evelyn's story into trial and have a different theory of the case, and the evidence prevail. Somebody who has lost blood, who was unconscious, who was delivering at home, just didn't have the capacity to, the legal criminal capacity to commit a crime, and that the evidence was just there.
So Evelyn Hernandez spoke with the BBC from prison before her acquittal. I want us to hear just a little bit of that conversation.
The case was concluded that you had killed your child. What actually happened in your eyes?
So Hernandez says, authorities say I gave birth elsewhere, that I had the fetus in my hands and I got rid of it. I never did it, not intentionally, because if I knew that I was pregnant, I would have had prenatal care and I would not be here in jail. I declare myself innocent, she said to the BBC. What would you say is the relevance of this case in El Salvador for women in the U.S. today?
I live in New York. I live in the U.S. I am an attorney here as well as I am in Latin America. And I just always compare Salvador to what can happen if we don't pay close attention here in the U.S. El Salvador used to have exceptions to this law. Until 1998, there were some exceptions. There were no cases of criminalization of women. There wasn't social cruelty in the system. And in a moment, the system completely changed. And I think that we as activists need to see El Salvador as a warning of what happens when laws are changed and when women and girls' rights are just not taken seriously and are not given a priority. So we have heard of some of the bans that they're trying to pass in Alabama or in Georgia, and they are even as harsh, if not harsher, than the ones that they are in El Salvador.
So what about the future for Evelyn Hernandez? She's acquitted, but she's just 21 and she's already spent more than 2 years in prison. Can she move on?
We hope that she will. She has a lot of support. She cried all night yesterday out of relief and happiness. I feel that she has been so strong and finally all her emotions let out. And she now can move on with her life. She wants to finish her high school and she wants to study. And it's going to take a while for her to process all of this and to heal from all this trauma. But we are there to support her and we are going to be with her all along the way until she feels ready.
Paula Avila Guigen directs Latin America initiatives at the Women's Equality Center. She worked closely with the defense team of Evelyn Hernandez, a Salvadoran woman charged with homicide and then acquitted of that charge this week. Paula, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
One mysterious explosion, 5 people dead, and now 4 nuclear monitoring stations gone quiet. That's what we know about an incident that took place nearly 2 weeks ago in northwestern Russia. But there is a whole lot we do not know. Evan Gerskovich is a reporter with the Moscow Times and is also trying to understand what's going on.
We know that around noon there was an explosion out at sea in the White Sea a few miles from shore that sent a plume up into the air and resulted in 5 staff workers for Russia's state nuclear agency being killed. In a nearby city, radiation spiked to between 16 and 20 times higher than the norm. Tons of confusion and a lot of misinformation.
As far as these nuclear monitoring sites, I mean, they've gone quiet. Has there been any comment at all on why they're not producing data?
Today, the first comment came from the Deputy Foreign Minister, Sergei Ryabkov, and he said that the decision to transmit data is strictly voluntary. So they chose to take them offline so they wouldn't actually be able to transmit data. And analysts that we spoke to today said that that 100% likely is for national security concerns rather than keeping the public in the dark. It's more to keep the United States particularly in the dark.
Mm. Tell me more about this province where this explosion took place. What is it like?
So Arkhangelsk is a region about 1,200 kilometers north of Moscow. It's quite on the periphery of Russia. It's about 1 million people. And Moscow, which has had a tough time handling an overflow of trash, decided about a year ago that it would send much of its trash out there, thinking that, you know, it wouldn't be near a lot of people. Nobody would really mind. But over the past 6 months, we've been seeing protests over that. And then this happens.
You actually connected with 4 doctors who work at the hospital where these patients were triaged, and another health worker from there also spoke with you. And they told you anonymously that they did not know these patients had been exposed to radiation. Tell us more about that, and how did you actually confirm those details?
I worked on this story with a colleague, and we basically went doctor by doctor, and they all told us identical timelines with identical details that we confirmed through each one. None actually treated the patients directly because from what every single one told us and in details in some other local outlets, the doctors that actually treated the patients were reportedly actually had to sign NDAs the following morning.
So non-disclosure agreements signed by the doctors who were in the presence of those patients. The government apparently has denied all of that about the NDAs.
The government has denied everything about the NDAs. The government has denied that these doctors were put in danger. These doctors said that they didn't know that these patients had come close to radioactive isotopes. They had their suspicions because they had heard about an explosion earlier in the day, and the patients, as far as our reporting shows, arrived naked in these translucent plastic bag carriers. So the doctors realized that they must have been coming from a military site. They were confused as to why they were coming to a civilian hospital. Nonetheless, they got to work. And after the fact, the health ministry offered these doctors to go get tested in Moscow. And this the health ministry confirmed on Saturday.
With so much mystery surrounding this accident, I can't help but think about the harrowing memories of Chernobyl and how people didn't know about what happened till days later and the full impact until months and even some years later. What have you been hearing just in conversation in Moscow when it comes to the past track record of Russia/Soviet Union transparency when it comes to radiation?
First, it's important to point out that scale here is much, much, much lower. There's so far 5 people died from this explosion, and it seems like a lot fewer people were actually exposed. And locals will admit that in conversations where even if they're confused, they seem to believe that the scale itself is much lower. But what they're all angry about, and what I think what our reporting has shown, is that the response pretty much mirrors what happened all that time ago.
Evan Gerskovich with the Moscow Times, which is trying to get to the bottom of this mysterious explosion in the north of Russia. Evan, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me on.
Sometimes an ordinary object can evoke strong feelings, even something as simple as a cooking gadget. Take a listen.
My mom is known for being a really great cook, and she's really known for her lumpia and for her empanadas. My name is Rachel Ronquillo Gray. I grew up in rural northern Nevada. My mom is from the Philippines, and she immigrated here in 1984 and had me 1 year later. So I really started thinking about cooking when I was in college, and being homesick for my mom's cooking meant that, you know, I needed to make it for myself. And the goal was always to make it taste as close to my mom's as possible. And my mom gave me this empanada press because I kept calling her up and being like, Mom, how big is it? How do you cut the dough for this? How do you make sure it's the right size? And so she was like, I'm just going to send you an empanada press. When my mom got it for me, I was really touched because, you know, this was like something we were sharing. Like we're bonding over this. And here's a thing, here's a tool that you can use in your own cooking. And so that felt really special to me. And I was like so excited to use it. It's like, these are going to look exactly like my mom's. It's going to be perfect. And when I first tried it, I was like, how does my mom fit all the fillings in this tiny little thing and not have it just bust out everywhere? When I try to take off the excess dough from the sides, it's just ripping the dough and making it look so ugly. And like the edges are not crimped the way they're supposed to because they've been ripped off. And I remember getting so frustrated. I tried so hard, but I just got really mad. And I was like, I'm not going to use that anymore. I'm just going to do it by hand. And I told my mom that. She was like, why? That's going to take you a long time. Why are you doing it that way? And I was like, I don't know how to use it, I guess. You're going to have to show me. I go home more often now to see my mom because she has lung cancer. And it's stage 4 and it's incurable. I really want to cook with my mom as much as possible with the time that we have. And so any question I have, sorry, I'm getting emotional. Did not plan for this. Any question that I have, I want to ask now. And so whenever I go to see her, I'm like, let's make lumpia together. Let's make empanadas together. Let's make shoe pao together. Show me how to make pancit, or just I'll do it and you can just tell me, or we can do it together. I feel pressure to get the empanada press right. It's, it feels like I have a little bit of a deadline, I guess. I don't know what the deadline is. I don't know what the timeline is, but like it feels like I want to get it right.
Rachel Ronquillo Gray is a poet, writer, and baker in Bloomington, Indiana. She told her story to producer Nicole Wisler, based in Philadelphia. It comes to us from the group Feet in Two Worlds, telling the stories of today's immigrants. Coming up, we speak with Kurt Volker, the U.S. Special Envoy to Ukraine. He says diplomatic efforts to bring the conflict in Ukraine to an end are being stymied by Russia. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. A political earthquake in Italy today. After months of government turmoil, Italy's prime minister has resigned. Giuseppe Conte is out, and that might be good news for Matteo Salvini. He's the leader of the right-wing Lega Party and often described as the European Donald Trump. Now the door is open for Salvini to push for early elections and perhaps occupy the top position himself. All this depends on what Italy's president, Sergio Mattarella, chooses to do next. Lorenzo Codogno is former head of the Italian Ministry of Economy and Finance, and he told us what's happening.
Well, today, Prime Minister Conte resigned, and now the crisis is officially open. So I think now it's up to President Mattarella to decide the best course of action. Given the debate in Parliament that we had today, it looks very difficult to have a sort of unity government because many political forces said they are not available for that.
So you're basically saying that a coalition at this point is essentially impossible.
I think it's very difficult. Not impossible because President Mattarella will try. It's his job to try to avoid elections and try to see whether conditions are in place for an alternative government, but I would say it's very challenging at this stage.
Lorenzo, I'd like us to hear the thoughts of one resident of Rome. Her name is Antonella Scaramucci.
Che succede adesso col governo? Che Salvini ha riscosso consenso.
And she's saying, what happens now with the government? Salvini has surged in the polls and is demagogically perfect. I think a new Mussolini era could be expected. She's not alone in those concerns, but let me get your take, Lorenzo. Do you believe that? Could Italy return to a Mussolini-style dictatorship?
I don't think there is a risk for that, but clearly Salvini is leaning to the right, and there are some disturbing similarities with positions taken in the past by far-right movements. The more Salvini gets in terms of votes on his own, and the more he can rely only on the League votes to govern, that would increase the risk, in my view.
If elections are called in Italy, will Matteo Salvini win?
I think if we believe opinion polls, which nowadays it's a very strong assumption, but because the electorate is very volatile and can shift behavior quite quickly, but if we believe opinion polls, Matteo Salvini is leading with a percentage of votes around 37-38%.
That was Lorenzo Codogno, former head of the Italian Ministry of Economy and Finance. A lot of eyes right now on President Sergio Mattarella. He'll be the one ultimately to decide if Italians go to the polls early. The conflict in Ukraine has been going on now since 2014. Just for context, that is longer than World War I. It all began when Russia surreptitiously occupied the Crimean Peninsula, including the key naval bases at Sevastopol. That was February 2014. A few months later, in April, pro-Russian elements raised the flag of insurrection in eastern Ukraine with covert support from Mother Russia. Since then, the conflict has killed an estimated 14,000 people. So what has the U.S. been doing about Ukraine? Kurt Volker is U.S. Special Representative for Ukraine Negotiations.
Well, several things. On the one hand, it's been very important to strengthen Ukraine as a country. So in terms of its democracy, its economy, its military capabilities, so that it is sustainable and it's clear that Russia is not going to be having any kind of decisive impact on the future of the country. Ukraine has become more unified, more stable, more prosperous, more pro-Western, more pro-NATO, more pro-EU, and more Russia-skeptic than ever before. So in terms of any strategic objective, we've kind of already seen that Russia has been denied that strategic objective.
Yeah, but
the second piece of
keeping
that,
keeping Ukraine as a country does include that territory in the east, though, doesn't it?
Of course, yes, of course. The second piece of seeking a peace and resolution here is to hold out a hand of being willing to negotiate to bring that territory back under Ukrainian control. Thus far, we've not had much progress on the diplomatic track. Russia still denies its responsibilities for leading the occupying forces and for paying for them and for preventing a ceasefire, not withdrawing their heavy weapons, not disbanding the illegal armed groups. So Russia's in denial about that and trying to put the blame onto Ukraine. I hope, however, that with the new Ukrainian president, new Ukrainian government, there will be some new opportunities here for negotiation as well. And that's what we're going to be testing in the next few weeks. What we need is a more constructive Russian approach. Maybe as Ukraine gets stronger and more stable, and it's clear that Russia is not gaining anything by this conflict, that Russia will be, in fact, willing to eventually negotiate a solution.
Is a hope that if an agreement on eastern Ukraine is successful, that Crimea could enter the picture at a later stage?
Well, I would hope that. I'm frankly not optimistic about that. Given what we have heard from the Russians, they refuse to even discuss it. So I think of this more like the situation with the Baltic states, where we had a situation where the Soviet Union took over their territory and tried to forcibly incorporate them into the Soviet Union. We issued a declaration in 1940 called the Wells Declaration, where we rejected that forcible takeover. And it's lasted a very long time, but eventually the Baltic states did get their independence back. And I see a parallel here with Crimea. We're not going to see quick movement on Crimea, but likewise, no one is going to accept that it has been taken over by Russia. And in the end of the day, I would expect that it eventually will become restored as a part of Ukraine. It's just going to take a very long time.
I'm curious, Ambassador, how often do you consult with President Trump? And what's your sense of how Trump would like to see the conflict in Ukraine, as well as the occupation of Crimea, resolved?
Well, I think that, you know, he said in his very first meeting with President Putin that Ukraine matters and that this is in the way of establishing a better U.S.-Russia relationship. And that has proven to be true over the last couple of years, that we haven't made progress anywhere as this is still in the way. So I'm in very close contact with the entire team. I've met with the president, and we've talked through where we are. The president is very skeptical, frankly, that Russia has the intention to end the conflict or walk away or come to a real resolution. But he's willing to keep a hand outstretched to try if Russia is willing, and that's what we need to be doing. There's a lot of engagement here. And in addition to my efforts, we have a lot of other people that are committed to this. I work very closely with all of them. And I think it has actually produced, I have to say, a more positive result than some people might have thought a couple of years ago. If you wind back the clock and you say, well, what were people asking in 2017? They were asking whether the Trump administration would recognize Russia's annexation of Crimea, or whether we would be lifting sanctions, or whether the EU would be lifting sanctions, and would the Trump administration be willing to lift the Obama-era arms embargo? And all of those things have taken place, and they've all strengthened the situation for Ukraine and made Russia's invasion and occupation less and less tenable.
Ambassador Kurt Volker, U.S. Special Representative for Ukraine Negotiations, thanks very much for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to The World. Mona Boyd moved to Ghana decades ago and gained a new perspective on racism in America.
It was like having a psychic burden taken off of your shoulders, and you didn't have to second guess why you failed or why you succeed. It wasn't about race.
Our reporting on the legacy of slavery, still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, PRI, and PRX. The political tug of war over Hong Kong's future has been going all summer long, not just on the streets of the Chinese territory, but also on social media.
You know nothing about Chinese citizens. Now I got some words from your president.
Well, something's probably happening with Hong Kong.
Somebody wanna split Hong Kong from us. They started a riot.
That is patriotic Chinese hip-hop. One example of pro-Beijing voices on social media criticizing the Hong Kong protesters. It's also part of what Twitter and Facebook are now calling a state-backed Chinese disinformation campaign. The World's Southeast Asia correspondent, Patrick Nguyen, has been following the story.
It's a conspiratorial rap tune alleging that America has some hidden hand in the Hong Kong protest. Okay, fine, whatever. You see stuff like that on Twitter every day. What's interesting is that Chinese state media has been very active on Twitter lately. This video was actually a paid ad on Twitter. So a Chinese state media outlet actually paid to put that on Twitter.
Well, as we already know, Twitter and Facebook have come out and said that they're cracking down on accounts linked to the Chinese government campaign against the protesters in Hong Kong. So what does this mean for Beijing, Patrick?
here we have Twitter actually blaming China's government directly. I think that's why this is such a big deal. Twitter has called this a state-backed information operation. This is very similar to the accusations against Russia during the 2016 race. And they've said there's more than 900 accounts backed by China covertly. They say they're going after this. This is a quote from Twitter. Larger spammy network of 200,000 accounts that are backed by China. And so it's a direct accusation.
It's not just this rap video. There are also memes. What are you seeing coming from mainland China in this meme space?
This is what Twitter has really tried to root out. We've seen these memes. Some are in English, but most of them are in Chinese. And they will compare the Hong Kong protesters to cockroaches. So they'll take some of the more prominent protesters and Photoshop their heads on the bodies of cockroaches. They will compare them to ISIS, basically to denigrate the protest and imply they're not coming from a real place of grievance.
What is the aim here by the Chinese government? Is it hopefully to stop the protests and scare people, or is it something else?
I think it might be something else because they're going after the Chinese-speaking world writ large, all around the world. And so I think they're trying to nudge people who are on the fence. This is trying to get at people all around the world in the networks that China can't control. Remember, Twitter, Facebook, that stuff's all cut off in mainland China anyway. So they're trying to reach the Chinese speaker in not just Hong Kong, but Taiwan, in Vancouver, in Sydney, in London and New York. And they're trying to tilt them more towards the Chinese perspective.
And does mainland China have receptive audiences in Australia and Vancouver and New York?
I looked at Twitter's data here to see how popular these memes were. And I saw a lot of them getting zero retweets, zero likes. The memes are a little clumsy. They're a bit uncreative, you know, putting someone's face on a cockroach. I think the Chinese disinformation department needs to work on the dankness of their memes because these aren't terribly effective and they're not terribly creative either. And frankly, when you look around the world at all of the state-run disinformation campaigns playing out on American social media, they're all like this. They're all kind of corny or overly vicious. Look at the Russian memes. Hillary is aligned with Satan. You know, it's never all that clever, and we have to wonder if it's really creating an intellectual impact.
The World's Patrick Nguyen. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco. Appreciate it.
This week marks 400 years since the first enslaved Africans arrived in Virginia. To commemorate that milestone, Ghana in West Africa declared a year of return for the African diaspora, and they invited American leaders like House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to come visit. The World's Rupa Shenoy has also been in Ghana, reporting stories about different perspectives on the history of slavery. Today, a story about the Black American experience in Ghana through the eyes of the woman who organized Pelosi's visit.
At the Avis car rental in Ghana's capital, Accra, franchise owner Mona Boyd sits in the big corner office.
Hi, I'm Mona Boyd.
Mona's at the center of a tight African-American community in Ghana. She's one of the organizers of Ghana's Year of Return, and she's arranged visits by U.S. diplomats and elected officials for years. Still, when she was asked to help with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and the Black Caucus's visit, she was surprised.
I just couldn't believe she was coming. I wouldn't call it mitigation, but it's just an acknowledgement, yes, this did happen. And you're not crazy for thinking that this awful thing happened. It did happen.
People had seemed to deny the slave trade happened her whole life. The focus had always been on moving on. Maybe because it had to be. Mona grew up in segregated Arkansas. She remembers her parents whispering about lynchings in the kitchen early in the mornings, thinking she couldn't hear. In sixth grade, though, she learned that there was another place where people who looked like her lived in pride, not fear. Some visitors from Tanzania came to her nearly all-Black school.
This was like, wow, meeting the queen to us.
Mona's been drawn to Africa ever since that day.
Most African Americans, you know something is missing and you want to be united with it. If you have any level of awareness about your own identity, where you came from, you would have to start asking those questions.
Mona's something of an expert on this. She owns a tourism business for African Americans traveling to Ghana.
Some African Americans, they have a different mindset about Africans. They think there is a much deeper brotherhood than what I think. But we all have a right to handle this in our own way.
And she's seen many times how powerful the experience can be for people, standing in the same place as their last ancestor to leave this continent.
You just don't know what's going to happen once they get that emotional. We've had people have mental breaks.
It's a tough history to confront. But if you're going to acknowledge that it's been 400 years since the first Africans were forced to leave Africa and arrived enslaved in America, that brings up an obvious follow-up question. 400 years ago, how did it start? So we're going to come back to Mona. But first, I went to see a local historian who's also a former mayor of Accra.
My name is Nat Amatefiu.
People around here affectionately call him Uncle Nat. I asked him to go back to when the transatlantic slave trade began. Uncle Nat explains that leaders in this region had a lot of gold, and word got back to the Europeans. In the 1400s, the Portuguese showed up here with guns.
Primitive guns, but guns. It made a hell of a difference.
There was already a domestic slave trade when they arrived, Uncle Nat says, although slavery didn't mean what it came to mean in America. Enslaved people had some rights and opportunities. Still,
the system already existed. The Europeans saw it and thought, we can try these people in our lands in the New World.
But Uncle Nat says the Europeans weren't going out and capturing Africans. They couldn't. They got sick and died from illnesses like malaria. So some African ethnic groups went into business, warring with other groups so they could capture prisoners they sold as slaves to the Europeans. Uncle Nat says they were organized and intentional about it.
To pursue slavery successfully, you need a highly organized group because somebody has to lead an army there. Somebody has to capture them, transport them to the selling centers, all the time keeping an eye on them to make sure they don't revolt, and then sell them and move on.
Anyone could be captured and taken. Eventually, the Portuguese were replaced by the Dutch, then the British in Ghana. Then, around the world, came the abolitionist movement, the French Revolution, and increasing revolts by enslaved people, all spreading ideas about equality and humanity.
Of course, when the slave trade was abolished, it was a result of a long negotiations with slave owners in Europe, as well as with slave owners here. The big slave-holding nations also demanded repayments.
The British made treaties with African chiefs to protect them from other ethnic groups in a series of wars. Uncle Nat says the British used those agreements to eventually declare themselves the colonial rulers.
They hoisted a flag and claimed that they were now sovereign.
It was 1874. During British rule, Uncle Nat says the African role in the slave trade was deliberately forgotten.
There is a willful amnesia about the roles that we played in the slave trade. Our chiefs and peoples decided, all right, we will not talk about it. Don't ask, don't tell. They created a mythology that we were innocent bystanders whose land was raped by Europeans.
In 1957, Ghana became the first African country to break away from colonial powers and declare independence. It was the height of the U.S. civil rights movement. Martin Luther King Jr. spoke at Ghana's first Independence Day. African Americans started to travel to Ghana. Uncle Nat was in his first year at university. He and some friends were asked to serve as guides.
So I remember they asked us, so who was sold? We said, oh, only the bad people, thieves and drunkards.
They were just making it up because they didn't actually know what had happened.
Especially since the history had never really been taught. And what history was taught was very sanitized. It was a disaster. A lot of African Americans were very disappointed to find this kind of blasé attitude.
This was about the time Mona Boyd first came to Africa. She had just graduated as part of one of the first classes of African Americans out of Boston College after the Civil Rights Movement.
Most Africans, when I came to this country, would not admit that this even happened.
But that was overshadowed by the personal experience Mona had visiting slave castles.
We were constantly, my generation, trying to prove to white people that we were good enough, we were smart enough, that we deserved to be there. But after I had gone through those castles. I didn't care what you thought. You just couldn't define me anymore. To be honest with you, I just felt I am from an incredible group of people. We fought and we thrived. And it made me feel so proud, a kind of proudness I'd never felt before.
Mona went back to Boston and met her Ghanaian husband, Eric, at one of her professor's parties. She went into real estate. Eric was in IT. Soon, they were both making six figures, living in a brownstone in Boston's historic South End.
We were trying to get pregnant when the Rodney King thing happened.
Three police officers facing felony criminal charges were among a group of 15 who stopped a 25-year-old black man, then beat him, kicked him, and
it was 1991. She remembers watching that video of Los Angeles police beating King after a traffic stop.
I remember just weeping, weeping, weeping. And I said to my husband, I'm not going to get pregnant if you don't agree to move back to Africa to raise our son. Why should we raise our son here when our son can go to your country where he will not be marginalized in any way?
Her husband agreed, and their son Selassie was born later that year. Then they moved.
It was a gift to him because we gave up a lot.
They ended up going into the independent car rental business. And Mona found working in Ghana liberating.
I was able to let go that conscious thought about race. Is it race? Is it my color? I was able to leave that. And it was like having a psychic burden taken off of your shoulders and you could just move.
Mona didn't realize she had more of that psychic burden to shed until a few years later. In 1994, then Ghanaian President Jerry Rawlings apologized for the African role in slavery.
And it just made me feel so much better. I stopped feeling resentful, you know, towards Africans about slavery.
Now, contemplating retirement, Mona's decided she wants to make a lasting change by adding to the small number of Ghanaian business owners. She's going to pass her business on to a colleague she trained.
Maoli started working for us right out of school. He was 24 years old when he came to work for us.
Together, they've made her tour company one of the most successful in Ghana, in part by offering tours aimed at helping African Americans reconcile with history.
It's a very emotional thing that we do because for the first time, Africans are saying to African descendants of the slaves, we're sorry, forgive us.
What they do is take tourists to a village that used to be a notorious slave market. African elders wash the visitors' feet. They eat together. There's drumming and dancing. Black Americans get African names. This year, more than 100 people are going through the process.
They understand, you know, what happened to black people and what black people lost. They took the brightest, the best, the strongest from this continent. So what would have happened had those people not left this continent? What would this continent be like?
Maybe in a way they'll find out now if more African descendants around the world follow Mona's path. Her son Selassie has chosen to stay in Ghana and pursue a career in music producing, even though Mona would have preferred for him to stay in the U.S. after college.
I thought he would have a better opportunity. I thought he would learn faster there, you know. And he said to me, nope, I am not going back there. I do not want to live in a country where they put 30% of the men that look like me in jail.
The reason Mona came to Ghana 30 years ago is the same reason Selassie is staying now. 400 years after the first captive Africans were taken from their continent and enslaved in Virginia, the U.S. still isn't a place Mona's family wants to be. For The World, Rupa Shenoy, Accra, Ghana.
Even as Ghana is asking for the African diaspora to return, it's in an argument with the U.S. over visas and immigration. Tomorrow, Rupa tells the story of Abdul Majid, who tried to reach the U.S. from Ghana by way of Brazil, and what happened that landed him back in Ghana. That's tomorrow. The Chinese crackdown on Uyghur Muslims in the western province of Xinjiang has been, by most accounts, massive. A million or more people detained in places the Chinese government calls re-education camps. Uyghurs outside of China are demanding action, but they've been harassed and intimidated too. Halmurat Hari is an activist and a citizen of Finland. He started speaking out when his parents were detained in Xinjiang. My colleague Carol Hill spoke with Hari from Helsinki.
Halmurat, when did you first start getting concerned about your family? I first started concerned about my family was beginning of 2017, April, if I remember. We have family tradition that every year when it's my birthday, I call my parents and they bless me. 2017, when I called my mother, she wasn't pick up the phone. And my father say she was taken to one of those camps. That's the first time I have heard about this so-called relocation camps. I'm afraid bad thing could happen to my mother because she is a cancer survivor. She got the major surgery a year before she was taken to one of those relocation camps.
And what did you do after you called home and your mother didn't answer? What did you do to try to find her?
So first thing was I'm collecting information to confirm that she was really taken to one of those camps. I called others, my relatives and my friends currently live in the region. Then I find out that many others' relatives are actually taken to so-called relocation camps. Then I find out it's not something only targeted my family. It's bigger.
When you were trying to get information about your family, about your parents, did Chinese officials ever try to harass or intimidate you?
Yeah, absolutely. They threatened all my contacts in the region. So all my friends, my classmates, and my relatives blocked me from their contact list. I cannot use WeChat. I cannot call them. When the major newspaper in Finland reported on my parents' case, I got a call from someone threatening me, says I have to be silent. Otherwise, there will be consequences. Then when we held demonstration in Helsinki, a few days later, there was two person. One is East Asian looking and the other one is Middle Eastern looking. They both taking picture of me and my family. That really scared me.
Have you gotten any support from the government in Finland in your quest to first help your own parents, but call attention to this whole issue?
Not directly. My car was vandalized. And I actually contacted local police. They were so rude to me and they were not really understand the situation. And I tried to explain what I'm worried about. And they say I watch too much Hollywood movies. That really hurt. Recently when I visited Turkey, I was planning to go to meet with few diplomats and someone followed me from Istanbul airport to Ankara airport and I really don't know what's their plan. There were a few of them that really scares me and I called the Finnish embassy but I really didn't see effective support. So I feel like except God Almighty and my prayers, I'm not really protected.
Your parents were released. When were they released?
24th December 2018, right before the Christmas.
And have you seen them since then?
No. My parents' passport been confiscated and they cannot travel. The Chinese authorities say to call them, make a reservation, and they go somewhere to talk to me under supervision. So their voice is not normal. I lost contact to my mother almost 2 years, and her voice is not sad. She says, thanks to the Communist Party for arranging such a good opportunity to study. It's not normal. And I feel someone just next to them, you know, forced them to speak, kind of.
So what do you plan to do next? Will you continue being an activist now that your parents have been released?
It is a difficult question, but I have no other choice until the situation gets better. I want to encourage Uyghur diaspora community to stand up and give testimony to the world what's happened to their family members. I'm continuing my campaign until my parents are totally, totally free.
Uyghur activist Hamurat Hari speaking with the world's Carol Hills. It's part of our collaboration with The Atlantic. The original story was reported by Ellen Halliday. There's a link to that on our Facebook page. We are at PRI The World. For our final story today, we're heading to a hidden location in northern Wyoming where the dinosaur hunt is on. A team of British, Dutch, and American paleontologists have uncovered a treasure trove of fossils there. One of the dig's leaders is Phil Manning from the University of Manchester.
There's an embarrassment of riches. That's the biggest problem. We have almost too much bone. Here, we're up to our necks in dinosaur bones.
And wouldn't you know it, the BBC science correspondent Jonathan Amos got special access to the Wyoming dig.
So if everybody could please turn off their geographical location services on their phones.
The subterfuge on the drive into Jurassic Mile is to ensure researchers have time to properly assess the site. And they're worried about fossil thieves as well. I'm descending into a small quarry that's been dug out of the side of a hill, and everywhere around me there are little flags fluttering in the wind which denote the position of a newly discovered bone. But in front of me there are some huge bones. What am I looking at, Phil?
This is the fossil remains of an enormous sauropod dinosaur. This is the long-necked, long-tailed dinosaurs typified by good old Dippy from the Natural History Museum in London. It's so rare you get to see so many bones strewn in front of you. This is like pickup sticks, but using dinosaur bones. It's absolutely ridiculously rich.
If you guys want to come down and take a look, we just found some really cool stuff.
London's Natural History Museum is here to find possible new display items. Dr. Susie Maidment.
The rocks here are about 150 million years old, and they were deposited by rivers and on floodplains, and they're called the Morrison Formation. The rivers and floodplains were inhabited by dinosaurs that we all knew when we were seven, so Stegosaurus and Diplodocus and Brontosaurus. But up here in the north of the basin, there's an increasing body of evidence to suggest that there are some new dinosaurs and some different ones from those that we find further south, and that's what we're hoping to test at this site here.
Professor Manning says paleontologists dream about sites like this, not just the huge number of bones, but also their giant size.
Wherever I tread, I've got to be careful that I don't step on dinosaur bones. This bone here, for instance, is the shoulder blade. This is the scapula. If you reach over and feel yours, it's a few inches long. This is over 2 metres in length. It's from an absolute titan.
The Children's Museum of Indianapolis has a 20-year lease to explore this small parcel of Wyoming ranchland. But given the richness of fossils, it's likely those 2 decades will see the scientists barely scratch the surface of what's set to become one of the world's most significant dinosaur dig sites.
The BBC's Jonathan Amos in an undisclosed location in Wyoming. And that'll do it for us today. Ned Porter composed our theme music. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for being here.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.